Welcome to Season 2 of Constitutional Defenders, where we discuss important issues and cases related to criminal defense and how criminal defense attorneys handle these cases on a daily basis. Today, we're speaking with Kenneth Nixon about his conviction and exoneration, as well as all of the great work he is doing today. Welcome to Episode 3. Welcome back to Constitutional Defenders. I am Lizzie, your paralegal producer extraordinaire. As always, with me is Mary Chartier and Takura Niamfukudza. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great, Lizzie. How are you?
Wonderful. Fantastic. Wonderful. How about you, T?
How are you, Lizzie?
I'm doing great, you know. All right. So who do we have with us today?
Lizzie, we're very, very honored to have Ken Nixon with us. Ken was wrongfully convicted in a case that started in 2005 and was just released in 2021. Since Ken's release, he has been doing amazing things all around the country. He's not just sitting around and celebrating his release. He's going out and actively working to help wrongfully convicted men and women be freed from prison as well and change our criminal prosecution system. Ken is the chairperson of the National Organization of Exonerees and has so much to share with us today, starting with his story and then the great work their group is doing. Ken, we're really excited you're with us today.
Yes.
Thank you guys for having me.
And actually, Ken, are you joining us from Michigan? Are you on the road? Where are you?
I am actually, I just crossed back into Michigan from Indiana. I'm returning from speaking to a group of students at Notre Dame University.
See, you're a man on the move all over the place. And I would say I'm your number one fan, but for those of you who like that movie Misery, you'll know that that is not good, right? Because she kept him locked up in her house. So if they invite you over for dinner, Ken, you know, make sure you let people know where you're going, right? So.
Absolutely.
Well, Ken, take us back, if you will, to 2005 and tell us how this really horrible experience for you got started.
This started in late 2004. My son's mother at the time was having an affair with a very close friend of mine. When I found out for obvious reasons, it became a very contentious relationship between he and I. It got, I guess you can say physical between he and I. It carried on for several months. Eventually, other people around us started to get involved, and we came to a conclusion that we needed to sit down and talk. We sat down and had a conversation, and we kind of settled on, you stay away from me, I'll stay away from you. We don't cross paths. We don't say anything to each other. About 2 months later, the house that he was living in, he lived there with his girlfriend and her five children. About 2 months after we settled, and our feud, someone set his house on fire. As a result of that fire, two children perished in that fire. And because of our prior history, my name came up almost immediately. Once my name came up, the police got tunnel vision. They honed in on me and they ignored all evidence of other suspects or of my innocence. I was arrested within hours of the crime taking place, and I was charged, tried, and convicted. I was eventually sentenced for 2 counts of felony murder, 4 counts of attempted murder, and 1 count of arson. I was sentenced to 2 natural life sentences plus 40 to 60 years.
How old were you at the time?
I was 19 years old.
You're a teenager. Was your lawyer, did your lawyer appear to be on your side and fighting for you? Or did your lawyer seem to think that, you know, you must have done it?
I think in the beginning, he wasn't sure what to believe. But as we approached trial and we got through a lot more of the proceedings, he began to believe and have more confidence in my innocence. The morning of trial, he came to me and told me that he believed that I was innocent. And that I think it was a buildup over the course of getting ready to go to trial, that everything that I'd said to him leading up to trial, he was able to verify and it checked out. And that built confidence in him that I was telling him the truth.
How long does trial last?
Trial lasted 9 days. We picked a jury for 2 days. Trial was 5 days, 2 days of deliberating.
And they come back. Kerr and I have been in this, right? The moment that they buzz and say the jury has a verdict, it is just, you know, your entire stomach is churning. I mean, you just can't think about anything else, and they can't get out there fast enough. When they come out and read the verdict and you find out that they convicted you, how do you feel in that moment?
I was actually numb. I was numb because moments prior to them saying they had a verdict, they'd actually sent a note out. And, you know, for obvious reasons, the charges were, you know, they started with the murder and then they proceeded to the lower charges. So the note was, could they find me guilty of attempted murder for a crime where nobody was injured or nobody had to go to the hospital? And the judge's response was basically, use your best judgment. When that question came out, I knew they'd already come to a conclusion on the murder trial, on the murder charges. So I was already kind of like bubble guts at that point. So as we go back to the bullpen, literally before the officer could lock the door in the bullpen area, taking me back, they announced that they'd had a verdict. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, instantly paranoid because I knew they'd already passed the murder charges. We go back into the courtroom and it was just guilty on everything. And I was just kind of like numb to everything that was being said. And, you know, honestly, everything after guilty for probably about an hour, I don't even remember. Like, I don't remember what happened. I don't remember, you know, getting back to the bullpen. I don't know anything in between that.
Did you have family there waiting for the verdict with you, friends, any support?
Yes, there was actually a full courtroom full of people. And I mean, they weren't in the courtroom, surprisingly. After the judge gave his instruction, you know, his response to the jury question, he dismissed everybody thinking that they would be deliberating for a little longer. So when they announced that they had a verdict, there was nobody in the courtroom but me. My family, friends, supporters, they were told after.
Your family, Ken, wasn't in the courtroom when the verdict was read?
No.
How did they find out about it?
Later on, when the judge reconvened, he told them what the verdict was.
Did they stand by you for all these years while you fought to prove you were innocent and get out?
Yes, absolutely.
That's amazing. I mean, we know some clients who, you know, family support has been lacking. That's amazing.
I had a very unusual, I guess you can say, amount of support and people standing behind me as I went through the process.
What about the appeals? Did your appellate lawyers raise some good issues for you, do you think? And you think you got a fair shot on that?
I think on my direct appeal, no. I think it was really... in my opinion, I think he didn't want to be involved at all. In fact, the guy that we retained to do my direct appeal wasn't even the person that did it. He contracted out to somebody else within his office. I never actually, to this day, I've never actually met the person that we retained to do my direct appeal. It Wow. was passed along to someone else. And I think that it was just another stack of papers on his desk. I don't think that there was very much effort placed into it. When he came to see me, it was, he'd already had his brief, his issues already, you know, prepared. And it was sort of like, here's your copy. And I'm out of here. Supreme Court. From you?
He just said, that's it. He didn't ask your opinion or anything?
No, not at all.
Oh my.
Not then at all.
When you get to prison, are you hopeful that at some point, this will, you know, this mistake will be corrected? Or I mean, it's not even really a mistake, right? I mean, because ultimately we learn this is intentional conduct that right. led you to be wrongfully convicted. But if you believe like the jury made a mistake, or is there a time where you don't have hope?
Yes and yes. When I went into the prison system, I was very hopeful that the system would get it right. I didn't know that I was only entitled to a lawyer for my direct appeal. None of my family had ever been in trouble, so we didn't know how the system worked or the ins and outs of it. So I assumed that the appellate process would correct the errors that were made at trial. As we continued to get denied repeatedly, my faith began to waver. The losses start to build up. And I don't mean just, you know, the court losses. My family's losing, you know, ridiculous amounts of money paying attorney fees and private investigators. You know, that stuff started to build up. And I started to question myself, was it worth continuing to ask them to, you know, keep retaining different attorneys? We're paying, you know, ridiculous amounts of money to bring in attorneys, and we're getting no results back. We're getting nothing but more and more denials. So the same amount that we paid to our cheapest attorney, you know, the same effort we got from our cheapest attorney, we got from the person that charged us the most, and we still got denied. So it seemed like we were running in place and getting nowhere. So absolutely, there were times and moments where my faith began to waver, and, you know, hope wasn't such a sure thing. That, you know, happened several times.
So did you talk to us about FOIA and I guess how you helped get yourself out and what kind of role FOIA played in there. And by FOIA, I mean the Freedom of Information Act, for those who may not be familiar with it.
So I learned very early on through reading books from different, you know, Innocence Projects, attorneys, different stuff that I'd gathered over the years, that getting my hands on every single document associated with the case was extremely important. I also learned that going through the process of switching from attorney to attorney that, you know, the person can't effectively do their job if they don't have all the documents. So, I began to learn and teach myself about different Freedom of Information Act laws and how they worked. It seemed like we were getting nowhere for the first 10 years of my incarceration, nowhere. The city of Detroit wouldn't even respond when you sent in these requests. We were getting absolutely nowhere. 2015 comes along, and a group of journalism professionals lobbied the legislature of Michigan to increase the penalties. I was not the only person having issues with the Freedom of Information Act laws. Different professions were having the same issues. They lobbied the legislature to increase the penalties for violating the law and by not responding and just basically doing what they wanted to do. They were just taking the penalties on the chin. They were so small. The city was just taking the penalties. It didn't matter to them. So the law gets changed and the penalties get increased. I start to make more requests. I make more requests and I finally start to get documents. Eventually we gained possession of two memorandums, one from the police department and one from the prosecutor's office, that ultimately cast doubt on my guilt from the very beginning, from almost the day I was arrested. And I was able to use those to influence and encourage people from the Innocence Project and the Conviction Integrity Unit of my innocence.
So before you get to those documents and what is in them, which is extremely compelling, are you able to do the Freedom of Information Act request yourself, or do you, because you're in prison, so or do you have to have a third party try for you?
No, I had to have a third party. In Michigan, inmates are not entitled to use the Freedom of Information Act laws themselves. They are exempt from laws. In fact, I believe the law reads that they're not even a person. An inmate is not a person under that law. So you have to have a third party citizen make those requests for you. So I not only had to teach myself about the law, I had to find ways to teach other people how to use the law for me so that I could gain possession of these documents.
And then you get documents from the prosecutor's office or the police or both that are new to you?
Both. The first one I got was from the police department. And then not long after, I got some documents from the prosecutor's office. Both I had never seen myself, and I was sure that none of my attorneys had never seen them either.
So what's in the police document that has never been disclosed? And I mean, that is a requirement, right? So the whatever is in the hands of the police, prosecutors are supposed to turn over as well. And so what is withheld from your lawyer all these years?
The first document was a memorandum from the lead homicide detective in my case. It was written 3 days after I was arrested. And the document literally reads that it's obvious our star witness is being coached by family members. That line, we'd known and assumed for years that, you know, this was happening, but to actually see it in black and white from a detective, a professional, a person that's trained to pick up on lies, was a game changer for us. Not long after that, we received another memo through the prosecutor's office that was written by the prosecutor associated with my case that he as well knew that I was innocent. His opening line from that memo states, to be blunt, this case has serious problems. That line was an obvious indication that he himself neither believed in the star witness. From there, it goes on to read in the second page. There's a paragraph on the second page of the prosecutor's memo where he knew at a minimum of a month before my trial starting that there was another suspect. What we didn't know, or what we weren't able to prove prior to this memo, was that there was a previous house fire, and this family was the victim of that previous house fire as well. And in fact, there was a suspect from that previous house fire. It was a jealous ex-boyfriend of the mom, and that house fire was set in the same exact manner as the one in my case. And the prosecutor knew about it. He knew that there was a suspect for that house fire, and he never disclosed any of it to us.
Do you happen to know if this prosecutor is still practicing, Ken?
Yes, he is still a active Wayne County prosecutor in Detroit, Michigan. And he's also a law professor at a local college.
Wow. Talk about teaching the next generation. He's never apologized to you.
No, not at all.
How did you get the news? So when you because it's a third party, a family member, a friend who's out of prison, who's getting the memos, you know, the information that's been withheld from you and your lawyer all those years. How do they tell you? Do they tell you on the phone? Do they tell you in an email? Because, you know, JPay, they can email you. Like, and then what's your reaction? It's probably confirming in your heart what you've known all along.
Yes. Actually, it was read to me over the phone. We were kind of just, I just asked the person to sort of skim through the documents and tell me what you saw. You know, if anything looks out of place, let me know. And just so happened, just randomly, that document was on top and she's reading it to me. And when she reads past that line, I'm like, wait, what did you just say? And she read it to me again. And I was like, I can guarantee you my attorneys have never seen that document before. So I asked her to, you know, photocopy and send me a copy of it. And then once I got it, it was just like, wow.
Did you even want to hear what was in any of the other documents? I mean, who cares after you hear that, right?
Yeah, I mean, nothing else mattered after that. I mean, I knew and understood what I had in my possession at that point.
You learn there's another viable suspect who had done this before. You learn that their star witness is being coached by family and is telling all these different stories. What else is amassed that ultimately results in your release and exoneration?
We also eventually found out that the jailhouse informant was not telling the truth, which we obviously knew, but he slipped up and said something to someone that was later reported on, and it gave us a leg up and, you know, challenging this testimony. We know for a fact now that he's committed perjury. He said he didn't know details about the case, which we knew weren't true. He testified to not knowing facts or details about the case, which we knew weren't true. And then, you know, he slipped up and said something that he confirmed that he actually knew facts about the case prior to testifying.
So is he a guy who claims that you confessed to him in the jail?
Yes. He testified that I confessed to him, which for obvious reasons wasn't true.
So, and this is a guy you never met before, right? So his story is that you were like, hi, stranger, let me tell you about a murder that I, or two murders that I just committed. That happens so often. And I think people don't realize how frequently that someone comes in and makes a claim that somebody confessed in jail. And it's just ridiculous. And juries believe it because prosecutors put it in front of juries all the time.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, the sad reality of our system is all it takes is for someone to say something with no verification at all. It just takes for one person to say something.
So not to backpedal, but did you take the stand at your trial?
No.
Okay.
Now, once you get all this information, who works with you to ultimately get you out? Are you having trouble recruiting a lawyer or one of the groups to help you?
No. Once I gained possession of said documents, I eventually went with Cooley Innocence Project. Cooley Innocence Project was, they believed in my innocence from the very beginning. It took me a minute to convince them, but once I got the documents in my possession, they were completely on board. And then they work jointly with the Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit to review and verify the information.
How long did it take from the time that Cooley accepted your case until you learned that you were going to be released?
About 3 years.
It's a slow process, but from what I've been told for our exonerations, 3 years is considered fast. We had one that took 6 years, and I thought that was really slow. And then I was told by the Cooley Innocence Project, oh no, that's really, they said, Marla's exact words to me were, that's lightning fast. And I'm like, what? I thought 6 was so long. Yeah. What, tell us about what, you know, the other prisoners, as you were battling to like get out, were people supportive of your efforts? You know, did other prisoners like, I mean, you know, did they brainstorm with you or strategize or, you know, were people like on your side?
I guess the answer is yes and no. Of course, you have the people that are close to you that, you know, are always cheering you on. They believe in you just because of who you are. They know you as a person and your personality, but at the same time, you always going to have naysayers. You're always going to have people that just don't believe, you know, until it happens. So the answer is yes and no, for sure.
No, that first day home, I mean, describe that when you walk out and you take your first breath as a free man after having been locked up for so long. What did you want to do? Eat? Who did you want to see?
Within those first, that probably our first hour, it was just, everything was overwhelming. I stepped out and there was, of course, the natural thought is, you know, something's going to go wrong. They're going to come back and get me. So, you know, I'm thinking, hurry up and get to the car. Let's get out of here. I didn't know that not far from the prison, there was a sea of people waiting for me, literally, you know, a sea of love. There were media cameras out there. There were other exonerees out in the parking lot, you know, guys that I had never met that had just showed up to welcome me home. They were there in the parking lot. My family was there. My kids were there. The Innocence Project was there. You know, it was a huge crowd of people that, and mind you, this is February. It's a snowstorm going on and there's people outside, you know, freezing. Just, you know, to welcome me home. And, you know, it was a magnificent feeling. It was wonderful. From there, the first thing I wanted to do was eat. Like, we stopped at the local, whatever was the first restaurant, which turned out to be a McDonald's, not far from the prison. And I literally just wanted to eat.
Lucina wanted Burger King originally. That's what he said he wanted. That is his first meal. And Takura said, I can do you better than that. So he took him to Capital Prime, which is a really nice restaurant and got the biggest steak, you know, that honestly, I've
never seen. Yeah, it was as big as his own, the tomahawk steak was, yeah.
And then, you know, it had been 26 years and he was looking at the prices for drinks and said, is this for a bottle? And then Takura said, no, don't worry about it. Those prices have definitely gone up. Now, you were released from the prison and not a courtroom because of COVID, right?
Correct.
And that's interesting. And I don't, at least in our experience, the prison really limited who could be out in the parking lot. And it sounds like they did for you, because only two of us, Takur and I, were allowed in the parking lot. Everybody else had to wait in a golf parking lot down the road. And really, they didn't even want Takur and I to wait there. And I'm like, well, I mean, you know, the guy's going to come out and just start walking randomly. Like, he's expecting us to be here. It took a lot of convincing. How many people did the prison allow in your parking lot?
They were very lenient. The administration at the facility that I was at, they've got wind of my pending exoneration the day before. It was announced through the media, so they knew it was coming. The problem was that the time of day that my hearing was set for was like shift change. So they didn't want a lot of people in the parking lot while the officers were pulling in and out of the parking lot. So they actually had everybody go to like a training area not far from the prison. But to pick me up, I think there were four people in the parking lot to pick me up.
Well, it's two more than us. Did anybody, does anybody like apologize to you at the prison, or do they seem like happy that you're being released? You know, was there any of that?
The administration was very, very helpful and receptive. They, the deputy warden at the time was very understanding. The administrative assistant was very understanding. In fact, during the time that I had to wait for the order to be faxed over, he gave an officer an instruction to walk me back up to my room to load all of my stuff up onto a cart and bring it down. And that officer's instruction was to let me do whatever I wanted to do between the time I went to the room and the time they walked me to the front door.
Oh, nice. What did you do? Did you say goodbye to like your friends? And
Yeah, for the most part, I said goodbye to, you know, a lot of the guys. I loaded my stuff up on the cart. I made a phone call to let everybody know that, you know, we were just waiting for the order to be faxed over or emailed over. And I went back downstairs. A lot of the officers were receptive. They, you know, had caught wind of it on the local media. I'm sure they were sharing it amongst each other. So a lot of the more friendlier, cooler officers that I'd encountered over the years, I was at that facility for 5 years. So I knew a lot of the officers, you know, I knew some of the good ones and some of the bad ones, but a lot of the more open-minded officers were very receptive. They came, you know, they apologized for what the system had done wrong to me. They, you know, told me they hope I sue and that I get paid.
Nice.
Yeah. I was walked out to the parking lot by the deputy warden himself. In fact, he drug my cart out to the car.
Oh, wow.
If I could ask one more question before we move on to the amazing work you've been doing since you left, what did you have in that box or those boxes that you have with you? Because I can imagine that some people would say, I don't want anything with me from that chapter of my life. I want to leave it all behind. I mean, did you have a television that you left with people? And what did you take with you?
Only thing I brought home with me was my documents and my pictures. Everything else associated with prison, I left. Nothing was of any value to me. In fact, it was of more value to the people that I left it with. The TV, I left with the guy that didn't have a TV. The shoes and clothing, I left with people that didn't have shoes and clothing. You know, the food, I left with people that I knew to be hungry at certain times of the day and night. I brought home nothing but, you know, my legal documents and my pictures.
So I've seen you wearing a yellow T-shirt, actually, very recently. Can you explain the significance of what's this yellow T-shirt all about? I have a yellow wall. We have that connection with kindred spirits.
The yellow T-shirt represents the National Organization of Exonerees. We're a group of guys and women from all over the country, mainly predominantly from the Wayne County area. We're all exonerees, and we've formed a group called the National Organization of Exonerees. And our goal, our mission, is to reshape the system, criminal justice reform in every facet.
I love that. What are some of the things that you would like to see? I mean, I can think of 100 things that I would like to see changed, and far more than that. But what are some of the things that really tangible things that you would like to see changed that would stop people from being wrongfully convicted?
The very first thing that comes to the top of mind when I hear you ask that question is accountability. I think if we had more accountability within the system, it would slow down or deter a lot of the behavior that we see from rogue actors. I think if there was accountability or some form of punishment associated with certain acts of bad within the system, a lot of this would change. And I'm not foolish enough to believe that things don't happen, right? I completely understand that mistakes happen, but I think there's a huge difference between a mistake and something that was done intentionally. And in those instances where it was done intentionally, I would like to see some form of accountability had. The other thing I would like to see is more conviction integrity units all over the country. We're just at 100 conviction integrity units. There's over 2,600 prosecutors' offices all over the country. That's a small drop in the bucket. Wrongful convictions is not a local problem. This mm-hmm. is a problem that happens in every prosecutor's office in this country, but yet people don't want to confront the issue. I think that we should have more conviction integrity units, and I think they should be run by people with without a prosecutorial background.
Like Val Newman and Robin Frankel running the two in Michigan, Wayne County, and then at the AG's office. They are former defense lawyers with amazing credentials. They are commitment to social justice and seeing wrongfully convicted people be released. I don't think it could ever be called into question. They're both such amazing women. Clear, the material that was withheld from you, do you think that was a mistake or do you think it was intentional?
I think it was intentional. And the reason I say I think it was intentional, because after several requests and finally getting it, there's other organizations and other people that have made that same request following me getting it. And a lot of the information that I now know has been redacted from the following FOIA releases. So it's clear that they, you know, intentionally are trying to hide it. I can show you copies of a redacted version and a clean version, and that line is blacked out.
Wow.
That's crazy. So have you and others started to gather tools of any sort that will perhaps help smoke out these bad actors, these dirty cops, these prosecutors who just turn a blind eye to the ethical rules? You have a list of bad actors at all or anything?
Absolutely. We've started amongst ourselves. But again, we're exonerees. We're normal citizens, just like everybody else. Just, you know, we've started to build and compile our own list of, you know, bad cops, bad prosecutors. It may not be of any value today, but at some point it's going to be of significant value when we can show the world that, you know, this prosecutor has been associated with 5 or 10 wrongful conviction cases, or this cop has been hands-on in 5 or 10 or 15 wrongful convictions.
Well, and those as end up to hundreds of years, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
One of the things I hear a lot of people say is, I can't believe this happened. And they think that like the wrongful convictions are anomalies, right? It's so rare that it happens. And it makes me want to pull out my hair, because I think it's extremely common. And I think for every Ken Nixon who's been released, there are 100 other people just waiting to, you know, like to come out, who will never be able to get their hands on a memo that provides that withheld evidence or whatever. What's your viewpoint on that, having been in prison and then seeing this from, you know, your side as an exoneree?
I definitely 100% agree. For every Ken Nixon, there's 100 other innocent people in prison. I think people get a misunderstanding of the reading of, you know, the Constitution, right? It's you're entitled to a fair trial, and fair means, you know, just that, fair. It's not fair when one side's cheating. Mm-hmm. That's not fairness at all. If you have to cheat to win, you didn't win. I don't know how cleaner you can put it. If you had to cheat to win, you didn't win.
Right. And that's such a great sentiment. I mean, you know, that really is compelling, because people think, again, that's an anomaly. And then I had a prosecutor recently say, when we had an exoneration for a client who we were representing, oh, well, see, the justice system works, you know, he's being released. And I'm like, no, the justice system does not work. He was in prison for 26 years, right? This shows a huge failure on the part of the justice system. And he wrote like 5,000 plus letters trying to get a lawyer to help him. before he was released. So to me, it's just a massive failure. And I really applaud the work that you are doing. Are you getting a receptive audience from people? I would imagine, I mean, who could turn you away, right? You've got such compelling stories.
Absolutely. We're getting a lot of reception from not only people in the community, organizations are receptive to our message. Prosecutor's office, some prosecutor's office are receptive to the message. The reception has been widely, the same. People want to know what went wrong. How did this happen? And, it's not always a good thing when you're confronting the actors or the institution that produced these actors. It's not always a pleasant experience, but no one wants to trade that time in with me either, though. No one wants to, okay, you take that 15, 16 years and you sit in that cage and then tell me how you feel about that. Nobody wants to trade places. For me, it's a really personal issue because the people that are making these decisions, the people that are saying, that this is okay, will never see the inside of a prison. They'll never actually experience the inside of a cage. So, to challenge or to question whether or not what's being said is true or not, it's, I don't understand how you feel you're qualified to make that decision.
The use of that word cage, Kerr and I have spoken about this before too, and I know we've spoken about this on that podcast. I mean, that's what this entire system is all about. It's really taking like our fellow citizens, our neighbors, our friends, our community members, and then putting them, a human being, in a cage. And to me, that is such a huge like responsibility that I feel that system should be bending over backwards to make sure, as you said, that every single thing is fair, that you can't have, if you have a prosecutor or police officer who has had 5 wrongful convictions, they are in the wrong job. Either they are incredibly sloppy or they are incredibly deceitful. And I think quite frankly, it's the latter. But the fact that Val Newman cannot work fast enough. There are not enough hours in the day for her unit to review every application that's in front of her. We get hundreds, if not thousands, of requests from people asking us to take their case. And I, like some of them, I really believe people are innocent, but we run a private law firm, and so I'm like, unless Lizzie is fine with getting paid in hugs, which she is not.
I gotta pay my bills.
I know, right? I don't think your mortgage company is gonna be fine with you being like, hey, I don't have any money, but we got another guy out. So there has to be that balance. And I think it's so, the system is so broken in that regard. It must be tough. Have you left people in prison who you think are innocent?
Absolutely. 100%.
That has to be incredibly difficult, and probably so many mixed feelings that like you're getting released, but then this sort of like, why me, almost a survivor's guilt in a way, that you're leaving but other people, you're leaving them behind.
Yeah, of course you always feel that. I mean, these are people that you grow to have relationships with. These are people that you see, talk to, hear every day, for sometimes years at a time, sometimes decades, if you're lucky enough to be in the same place together. But, of course, there's that natural feeling, the joy of hearing your name called, knowing your time has come, is a remarkable feeling. But the thought that there's another person suffering from the same injustice that you just left, it's horrible.
Right.
Oh, question. I mean, so of course, while you're in there, I can't imagine that there are many of the corrections officers call you by your first name, right? It's inmate or number so-and-so. Once you're out, I mean, it's not all peaches and cream, is it? There are some people who don't care that you were exonerated, but to them, you're just still an ex-felon, right? And they don't care how it is that you got out, but to them, they can't get beyond the fact that you spent time behind bars. And talk about any challenges you faced getting housing and employment and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Before we go to that question, I want to go back to something Mary just said. You guys suffer from the same problem that Val has, and it's a lack of resources. You just don't have the funding to be able to work as many cases as possible. I mean, the funding is a huge part. And what I find so strange and obstructionist about that is the government can prosecute you with an unlimited amount of money. They can they can take you to trial five times, but they refuse to fund a conviction integrity unit. They refuse to properly staff a conviction integrity unit. That is something that, you know, society needs to know that. Society needs to know that they can rightfully send the wrong person to prison, intentionally send the wrong person to prison, but yet you don't have the resources to make sure that you're getting the right people when you make that arrest. That is just nuts. And for the people that say that the system works the way that it's supposed to, or the way that it's designed to, I would say to that person, if that were true, there would be no need for Innocence Projects, ACLUs, private attorneys. There would be no need for these people to step in and do what the system should have done properly the first time around. We wouldn't have to have these conversations if that were true.
Right. Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Well, Takur and I have spoken about this. This is essentially like the exonerations we've worked on. They're a side hustle for us because, you know, we're not getting paid for them. And so we have to have our retained cases that we're working on to pay the bills and, you know, to keep the lights on so we can see Takura's yellow office wall and everything. But then we, you know, we have these little like side hustles, and I agree with every single thing you're saying. If you have the money to wrongfully convict somebody, you certainly have the money to like release somebody who's in there. Right. Right. I mean, they've taken so much from you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to even think about that. You know, we've got a guy within our organization. They prosecuted him four times. Like, if we were to compare what it costs for them to prosecute him four times to what it costs to exonerate him, I promise you, there's no comparison in dollar value there. There's no, the government far outspent what his defense spent trying to get him out of there, far outspent, and they were wrong. They were absolutely wrong, and so basically, you can consider that a waste.
Right,
it's a waste. They wasted four trials worth of dollar value to send the wrong person to prison.
Right.
To answer your question, they don't call you by your first name. Your name is whatever your last name is and your inmate number. So I was Nixon 499036. One of the first things I encountered when I came home, I went to the doctor's office, and I didn't realize that the nurse was calling me into the back because she was calling me Kenneth. And I sat there probably for an extra 10 to 15 minutes as she kept coming back, calling me, and I wasn't responding because I didn't realize she was calling me.
That's crazy.
Wow. Did you explain? I mean, or was that like, what kind of a moment was that for you?
That was like the light bulb. Like, I didn't realize that people call people by their first names. It didn't even dawn on me that I was now Kenneth and not Nixon 499036.
It's such a way to dehumanize people, I think, to refer to them by a number and not, you know, not who you really are, the name that you have. And that entire system is meant, I think, to dehumanize.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. 100%.
Now I have to ask you this, because we were at the U of M really nice function recently where they were honoring recent exonerees. One of our clients was being honored, and everybody was talking about how they weren't bitter, including someone who'd been in prison wrongfully for over 40 years. And Takur and I, when we were walking back to the car, I'm like, I don't even like to wait 40 minutes for a meal. And I know he does not, right? He gets hangry. I have been out to like lunch and dinner with him, and if that food is not like, you know, coming out fast, he's looking all around. And I was like, I cannot imagine. Do you just get to a place where you're, because I thought these folks are such better people than I am, right? I'm angry for them. Like, I'm bitter hearing these stories. Do you just ultimately get to a place where you almost like become a better human being than the rest of us, you know, because of this burden that has been placed upon you?
Well, I can only speak for myself and probably a few of the other guys, because we've got some angry, bitter, hateful guys within the group. But for the most part, for me, speaking from experience, you kind of cycle through all of those emotions. I spent the first part of my incarceration mad at the world. I hated everybody. I eventually came to the conclusion that I couldn't help myself by, you know, being angry and being bitter. And, you know, again, my process was a little different. I had to use third party people to help me get what I needed. And I quickly realized that yelling at them and screaming at them and, you know, calling them names wasn't getting me what I needed done. Yep. So I had to change tactics. And part of changing tactics meant, you know, I had to learn to communicate better. So I had to do some soul searching and kind of get past those aggressive emotions in order to communicate effectively to get what I needed.
And then now you've been able to channel all that energy into helping other people, which is amazing, which is why we love you, Ken Nixon. We think you're the great.
Yes.
And just the time that you've been out in 2021, you've now ascended to the being the chairperson of the organization, which is also great. It shows your leadership skills. You're there for so many other people. I love hearing updates from you about where you are all over the country.
Don't stop. People.
No, don't stop. You get those frequent flyer miles and you go, go, go. We have appreciated you so much by being on this podcast. And I know all of our listeners will just really enjoy hearing what you had to say and keep up all your advocacy for social justice and to help people who have been wrongfully convicted and to prevent it from happening to someone else. Really, thank you.
Yes,
absolutely. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for being on with us, Ken. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you so much for joining us today while we spoke with Kenneth Nixon. We're so grateful for the support of all of our listeners. Stay safe out there.